owe them, but very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. As you can imagine, we get a lot of pitches from publicists about having their authors on American Warrior Radio. One of the inside jokes among hosts here at my flagship station is about publicists who apparently don't bother to read the topical nature of our shows before sending out a pitch. It's called American Warrior Radio. Don't waste my time or yours by sending a pitch about a cookbook. Right. We did have the Army White House chef on the show. Never mind. You get my point. We get a lot of authors on the show. Generally, the threshold is they have to have worn the uniform or written about a significant historical military event. And, of course, the book has to be good. What first hooked me on the pitch for today's guest was the fact that we have never had a firefighter author on the show before. Okay, send me a sample of his writing. Received. Hooked in the first few pages. Looking further into today's guest, what really sealed the deal for me is the extent to which he goes to help other aspiring writers hone their craft and hopefully move toward eventually becoming a published author. I really appreciate that. And if you're an aspiring writer, you're going to want to stick around to hear the rest of the show. So he's a good dude. And did I mention, he writes really good books. Welcome to American Warrior Radio, Mr. John Gilstrap.
Thanks for having me. Keep going. Keep talking about that stuff if you'd like. I like hearing it.
I'm pitching for a publicist deal myself, huh? John, I tell you, looking into your background and in our pre-interview, there's two things that both we have in common. We've both been firefighters, and we both share love for the smell of a freshly sharpened old-fashioned lead pencil. So we're off to a good start, right?
That's right.
I will say, you know, when I do get a new book like yours that came in the mail, my first thing I do is I kind of fan through the pages and take a good whiff. That's one of my favorite smells in the whole wide world, is a freshly printed book.
There's nothing that replaces real pages you can turn. I know that, you know, it's, for people who travel a lot, I think e-books are terrific, you know, because they're lighter and you can have, you know, 3,000 of them in your briefcase at the same time. But for me, sitting around the library in the house reading, it's got to be a real book. You know, just there's something about those pages. And you're right, the smell and the feel and the, mm-hmm. the crack of the spine when it's a new book. It's all very neat.
And, of course, you were going to mention next, when you travel a lot, you can download and stream American Warrior Radio podcasts, probably.
Absolutely. Did I leave that out? That was actually what I was thinking.
John, like my brother, who is also named John, unlike you, I'm not an adrenaline junkie. You and my brother John were. I just fought fires to pay for college. Tell us about Los Angeles County Station 51. Did you know there's going to be a quiz?
When I was a kid, I forget when it was on, Emergency, right, with Johnny Gage and Roy DeSoto. Their exploits were just fascinating to me. And when I was in college, I ended up taking a first aid course. It was a two-semester first aid course, so I guess it was kind of advanced. But part of the requirement for the course was that we had to do a ride-along with the ambulance. And the night that I happened to pick was a really busy night. And I was hooked, you know, right from there. You know, I start with Johnny Gage and Roy DeSoto, and then I'm playing one or the other in the back of the ambulance. And as soon as I got a chance, once I was out of college, I got my EMT certification and joined a fire department. And in Virginia, where I live, we don't have separate rescue squads, at least not in the jurisdiction where I live. So if you're an EMT, you're also a firefighter. And then, you know, once you enter the first fire, you know, you kind of get hooked. There is something about it. It's a young man's sport. I don't do that anymore. But, it was the adrenaline. Think about it. When you're 22 years old, whatever I was, I was very young, and people call the fire department on their very worst day. And you've got training and all that, but you never got the training that you think that you actually need when you show up. And, you know, you are 911. You're the best they're going to get. So you end up bringing order to their chaos at a very young age through, you know, kind of wild guessing and doing your very best. And then you get back to the firehouse, and it's like you changed the world. You know, it was just such an adrenaline rush. And I loved it. I did it for 15 years, about when I have 5,000, 6,000 calls, I think, over that time.
John, let's talk a little bit about that, because I've heard that, and obviously given the kind of guests we interact with here on American Warrior Radio, that phrase, you're interacting with someone on their worst day, I hear that both from fire personnel as well as law enforcement. A little bit of a different scenario, because I would get, well, as a firefighter, you cut them out of the vehicle and you throw them in the ambulance and you know, maybe you get them to the hospital, the emergency room, but then you're done there. You don't have to show up again and testify in court or do investigations of the murder. But I have to say, John, anyone who's actually smelled death, I guess is the way to describe it, that's something that it never leaves you. And I would guess 5,000 calls, I mean, after a couple hundred of seeing people on their worst day, that's got to kind of wear on your psyche, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it's not real time. Actually, since I've been out, and as I get older, some of the ghosts come back to haunt me. But at the time, it's, you know, it's their bad day. I have to keep it together because I'm there to bring order to the chaos. They don't need to have me add to their bad day, right? So I was sort of compartmentalized it. It was about the operation. It wasn't about the body in a front yard. It was about the fire. It wasn't about the dead person in the car. It was about the live person in the car. And it wasn't even, if I was on the fire truck as opposed to the ambulance, it wasn't really even about the person. It was about making sure that the Medibots could do what they need to do, so therefore cut up the car in just the right way. So, you know, it becomes a very focused job, and at the time, I was very able to sort of separate my emotions from it. There are always times it can't. I mean, kids, you know, that's the one that breaks through. But, you know, you're there to do a job, and like I said, we are 911.
John, not to take this in too dark of a direction, but, you know, we see the memes, I guess kids nowadays call them, or the scene is always the firefighter on the ladder rescuing the kitten from the tree. And that's about as warm and fuzzy, literally, as it gets. What can you think of? What was your most joyous occasion as a firefighter?
I delivered two babies.
Oh.
That was pretty cool. In fact, the first one, it was very early in the fire service. There was a driver and an aide. The aide was the medical person, and the driver was, in this case, was also a medic. And we showed up. It was in suburban Washington, or suburban Virginia, Northern Virginia. And, you know, you get these OB calls all the time, but they're never anything. And, you know, this baby was crowning. And I was like, oh, my God. So you pull out the OB kit and tear it open. And there was only one glove. And as I'm doing the thing that I
Wait, wait, wait. Is there supposed to be two?
Yeah.
Okay. Just a second.
Yeah. And, so as I'm doing what I think I'm supposed to do, the driver leans down and very quietly says, "Watch your breathing, John. You're hyperventilating." So, but it was born. I smacked it. It was a little girl. Didn't name it John, but it was. That was pretty cool. That was very, very cool.
Okay. Well, I wanted to end that on a lighter note before we go into the main topic of our conversation today. Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking with John Gilstrap. You can learn more at johngilstrap.com, G-I-L-S-T-R-A-P. He is a prolific writer, and we're going to talk about some of his books and he's going to share some great advice for those of you who might be considering getting involved in writing. Hey, listen, military first responders, or even business folks, if you're thinking about getting a challenge coin, we got our American Warrior Radio Challenge coins from Boss Custom Coins. You can find out more at BossCoins.com. I sent them the logo. They gave me some options for design. Their artists work with me. We happen to get a copper-colored coin to reflect the heritage of our flagship station here in Tucson. We went from design to in my pocket in 2 weeks. If you're thinking about getting a challenge coin or need to renew your existing coin, send me an email, bbg@americanwarriorradio.com. I'll personally put you in touch with the folks at Boss Custom Coins for a special discount. We love our new challenge coins. You will too. BossCoins.com. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking to John Gilstrap. You can learn more at johngilstrap.com. John spent 15 years as a firefighter, and then John, I guess you kind of kicked around different sort of desk jobs, corporate jobs, but in your heart, you always wanted to be a writer. And I guess you started even as a young boy doing short stories.
I did. I mean, making stuff up has always been part of what I did when I was a little kid, and we'd be playing guns or cowboys and Indians, whatever we were doing. I was always the storyline guy. You know, this is what we're trying to accomplish. And I've been an omnivore of a reader for my whole life. And I would always, I'd tell stories. It was one of the exercises in school that I always enjoyed, was to write short stories. And if you do it long enough, you develop a craft, I guess, and you can start making a living off of it.
Well, I tell you are prolific. I went to your website and I stopped counting. honestly, you all kinds of series. So would you consider the Jonathan Graves series sort of your flagship series?
Yeah, that one, I've just signed a contract for numbers 15 and 16 on that series. The 14th one is called Lethal Game. That one comes out in late June, early July, the last Tuesday in June. And then my other series, the second of which drops in a couple of weeks, is a Victoria Emerson series, sort of a post-apocalyptic series, although the marketing people hate when I call it that because these days post-apocalyptic means zombies, and it's not zombies. But so those are the two series that I'm working on, and then there's a bunch of standalone novels in between and a few short stories here and there. I got a short story coming out in an anthology sometime in May.
So combined, how many books have you published in total?
I'm working on number 25 right now.
Wow. And you can make a living doing that, I guess.
Yes, you can.
Well, if you're a New York Times bestseller like John Gilstrap, you can. But I tell you, I've been reading Blue Fire, your latest in the Victoria Emerson series. I honestly, John, I have to say I stopped about – it hooked me right in the first chapter. But I stopped about a third of the way through because I felt like I was coming in the middle of a movie. And I need to go back and read the first one first. I don't have to, but I'd like to. Crimson Phoenix is the first one in that series, yeah.
Right. And the Crimson Phoenix, and I've already started, and then it's Blue Fire, and I've already started on White Smoke, which will be the one that comes out this time next year. It is a trilogy. I work hard to make sure that they survive as standalones, you know, that there's enough background story that the current story makes sense. But there's certainly, I got to confess, there's, I think, probably a more detailed ride if you start at Crimson Phoenix and work through. What the story's about, Victoria Emerson is used to be a representative in the House of Representatives for West Virginia. And because of a number of mistakes that happen, the world gets involved in a nuclear war that lasts for about 8 hours. And Victoria is one of the survivors, which is kind of interesting. The way I went about this story, we hear a lot about survivalists who plan for Armageddon and for protecting their own families, and of course that's important. But sooner or later, you know, if billions of people die, then billions of people are still alive, and they're going to find each other. And it's about rebuilding society and dealing with the feral nature of people. And Victoria happens to be a natural leader that people listen to, and she's kind of the voice of sanity in the wilderness of madness. I'm really pleased with it. It's turning out. The early reviews for Blue Fire are really stunning.
Well, I tell you, John, honestly, I have to say, one of the thing I loved about your book and the reason it hooked me right off the bat is something that I find doesn't happen so much now in film and particularly TV shows. And some of these scenes I watch, I couldn't care less about the characters. But early on in Blue Fire, that's why I wanted to stop and go back and read the first in the series, because I immediately cared about these characters. I wanted to know more about them and how we got here and their background. Now, I will also say, John, that I was in about the chapter 3 when I talked to my wife about stocking up and getting a little more beans and ammunition.
you can't have enough beans and ammunition. Come on.
So you're,
that's just reality.
Your first published book, although not your first book, but we'll talk more about this. Your first published book was Nathan's Run, but then you also wrote a book called 6 Minutes to Freedom, and I'd like to talk a little bit more about that because that really hits to the heart of a lot of what we talk about here on American Warrior Radio. This dealt with a fellow by the name, if I'm pronouncing his name right, Kurt Muse?
Correct.
And he was he a CIA operative? Have we never figured that out, or is that now in the public?
No, Kurt Muse was an American citizen. The guy's about 6'4", very blonde. But he grew up in Panama, on the economy in Panama. His dad owned a printing company. But they lived on the economy, weren't part of the canal zone. And, you know, so he speaks Spanish fluently, and he was very big into the local Rotary Club. And when Noriega was doing his terrible shenanigans in the late 80s, Kurt saw his friends being killed. So he actually joined forces with his fellow Rotarians to buy, essentially, it wasn't Radio Shack equipment, but it was that quality equipment. And they figured out how to override the radio signals in Panama to broadcast a, you know, throw the bomb out, fight for your freedom sort of message during primetime radio and just trying to inspire Panamanians to rise up against this dictator. And the Noriega was not happy. He became public enemy number one. And it's a long book, so I'll try to keep the story short. But Kurt was ultimately betrayed and arrested. And on the night he was arrested, his daughter, who I think was 15 at the time, and his son, Eric, who was 12, they had to flee the country because the PDF was coming for them, too. They were coming for the whole family. And Annie, his wife, was out of the country. So the kids had to flee the country alone. And ultimately, it's a happy ending. Everybody's still alive. I'm not, no spoilers here. But Kurt ended up becoming, he was sent to Modelo prison and became the first objective in the Operation Just Cause invasion. The first shots, or among the first shots fired in that invasion, were his rescue by Delta Force from Modelo prison.
Now,
and that in itself is a hell of a story. So yeah, Kurt's a great guy, and it's a tremendous story of a lot of American heroes.
Now, La Modelo, that was unlike some of the places the Colombian drug lords checked themselves into. That was a bad, bad place. I mean, maybe one of the worst in Central America at the time.
Yes, it was terrible. Way overcrowded, and that was the point. You know, you take this American, they march him in front of the cameras, and American spy, which he wasn't. In fact, the CIA early on, until he was arrested, and you have some of the stuff that led up to that, this was not a government operation. This was just citizens.
Now, he was an Army veteran too, though, correct?
He did. He did 4 or 5 years. I don't know what it was. Not to denigrate. He was not a career Army officer.
So this was called Operation Acid Gambit, and it was a subset of Operation Just Cause, which folks might be more familiar with, the invasion of Panama. If I get this right, John, 23 Delta operators and the folks from the 160 Special Operations Aviation Regiment, the Night Stalkers, some of my favorites, went into this prison to pull Kurt out. Was that the first or maybe even the only time that you're aware of that Delta was sent in to rescue a civilian?
I believe so. I'm not sure. I don't know that. Actually, it's not a question I ever asked. I do know that that was involved, the 160th, as I understand, as I'm told, the Top Hat orbital operation, where you have two gunships flying orbits, one inside the other, firing down on the I'm trying to remember, what is it? It's a modified C-130 with all the firepower in it. Anyway.
Well, yeah, like a Spooky or some other, I don't know what they call them, that's what they call them in Vietnam, but a gunship, yeah.
Right. But yeah, it was quite the rescue. In fact, the rescue helicopter was shot down not once, but twice, and then it ended up in a running gun battle on the street. And, you know, it's a hell of a story. And I was shocked, actually, when I found out about it in probably late 90s, I think, is when I started to research that. I was shocked that the story hadn't been written. And what I found was that Acid Gambit, the rescue operation, actually had – there are some documentaries about it and all of that, but the story itself and the background of the story hadn't been told yet. And I'm happy to say that, as I understand it, 6 Minutes to Freedom is the first book that the Delta Force, who were very super secret guys, that Delta Force participated in terms of the research.
John, hold that thought. I'd like to follow up on that when we come back, because we've had only had two Delta operators on the show, Mike Vining, who was one of the original Delta members who was involved in that unfortunate incident in Iran, and then Tom Satterley, who was involved in the Black Hawk Down operation. I know they don't seek the limelight, and I want to kind of pick your brain about how John Gilstrap got these folks to talk. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia. Stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. We're talking with New York Times best-selling author John Gilstrap. John was in his previous life a firefighter as well. John, we're talking about Operation Acid Gambit before the break. The Kurt Muse was imprisoned by Noriega, I think 9 months in solitary, abused regularly. And tell me if this is correct or not. It was on Wikipedia, so I know it's got to be true, but let me just double-check with you since you wrote a book about it. Allegedly, an American colonel walked into the prison to talk to John and pretty much told everybody within earshot, if Muse is killed, no one will walk out of this prison alive. Did that?
That's right.
And that actually assigned a guard to dispatch him, and I don't mean that in a good way, to kill him if a rescue attempt was even attempted, right?
That's right. And that was the buildup. I don't know if you remember this or not, but there was Lieutenant Poss had been killed by PDF forces. He and his wife were roughed up, and he was killed. And the stakes in Panama were really getting hotter and hotter and hotter. And the Delta and the Just Cause was coming closer and closer. It was Blue Spoon back then. They were doing the run up, and they just wanted to make sure that the PDF would hesitate before shooting Kurt once everything started to blow up around them. And so that was the strategic purpose of that comment. But yeah, this guy went in front of God and everybody and said, if you hurt Kurt Muse, none of you walks out of this building alive.
That's a great story. That part of the story. It's a great story overall, but that part's great. Now, how did you get these Delta operators to actually speak to you? I've been shocked that I was able to get even two on our show so far.
Well, and to get them to talk about a specific operation is particularly daunting. And frankly, it almost scuttled the book because I had the family story, I had the co-conspirator story, I had Kurt's story, obviously. But I needed their side of things. So we decided to go through official means. That didn't work. And so we thought, okay, we met with Connie Mack, who was in the late 80s was senator for Florida, who had met with Noriega, and he couldn't help us very much, so he put us in touch with Brent Scowcroft, the National Security Advisor under 41, President Bush. And I bought him coffee that he didn't drink, and he didn't say much. He listened carefully. I think everybody was afraid, everybody was concerned that this was going to be a hit piece on the military or on the Bush administration or whatever. Obviously, that was not our intent. So after we met with General Scowcroft, about a week later, we got a call from President Bush's secretary, 41 secretary in Houston, saying the president would like to meet with you on Wednesday. Can you come down to Houston? Well, you know, let me look at my schedule. I had a dentist appointment that day, but okay. So we flew down to Houston, and we met with President Bush, who actually 43 had just been elected when we were talking to him. And he listened carefully. He's a genuinely nice guy, but we didn't get anything from him either. So other than, you know, being a fanboy, I flew back disappointed. And then within a couple of days, we heard from Jerry Boykin, General Boykin, who was then he wasn't the commander of the unit, then he was very senior. And he said, I don't know what you boys did, but you can talk to the guys. I'll tell you anything you want to know.
Now, correct me on the time, were some of these operators still in the active service at the time?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. Yeah.
That is impressive then.
Yeah. In fact, at the book launch party we had in 2006, I think, we had the entire, that whole squadron from the unit was at my house, and some of them were still in active duty, and some of them had just come back from either Iraq or Afghanistan, having done spooky stuff. And it's kind of neat. And one of the things I find really interesting about these guys, the special operators in general, is that while they're supremely efficient and good at what they do, they're also genuinely nice people. As my wife would say, not only are they gentlemen, they seem like gentlemen, which I think is kind of neat and surprising, quite honestly, because they're not the cliche that I thought they would be.
You know, one thing I've learned, John, myself in interacting, particularly with the tip of the spear types, is that they are unique individuals who have that ability to flip a switch within themselves. They can be extremely violent, and that's what they're trained and hired to do. But at the same time, they can shut that switch off, and you're right, they're the friendliest. I got one of my favorite Delta stories. I was with a buddy of mine at a local watering hole that was frequented by secret squirrels, and there was, about a dozen young men lined up there. And the owner came over and talked to me and my friend was former Army, and he said, well, who are those guys? I mean, you could tell they were military, but that's about it. And well, the owner rattled off a bunch of letters and numbers, and I don't know. My friend's like, wow, do you know who that is? And I have no clue who that is. So well, that's Delta Force. And my first response was, gee, they're smaller than I thought they'd be. They were not linebacker-looking dudes. They were sort of wiry, but definitely not someone I'd want to mess with.
Well, yeah, and I've heard through other groups, most recently through the FBI HRT, where I've got some buddies on there, too, hostage rescue team. But often it's the big linebacker guys, the most athletic, buff, work-out-all-the-time guys, are the ones who wash out, not because they're not strong enough, but it's really a mental game about teamwork and working together. This is obviously third-party information that I'm relaying, but I found that very interesting and actually consistent with what I've seen.
Well, John, speaking of mental discipline, let's take that rather awkward segue into sharing what some of our listeners can learn from your success and your experiences and your hard work as a best-selling author. If folks go to johngilstrap.com, and this is what I really like, John, you've got a series of videos that are also, you can get them through your website, but they're also on YouTube, where you just share ideas and suggestions about being an author and being a successful, how to get to become a successful author. And one thing that surprised me in talking to you is I would think, not being edumacated, that in today's world with the interwebs and laptops and all this stuff and, you know, publishing, that it would be easier. But you share with me that it's actually harder because it's more competitive because almost any schmo out there can now publish a book.
Right. When I was first getting involved with this, the guy I reached out to for help was Stephen Hunter. He does the Bob Lee Swigert series. And he was at the time, he was working at the Baltimore Sun, I think. He was the film critic. And I asked him if he had ever been rejected, and he said no, which wasn't exactly encouraging. But he said back when he first started, you had to type the manuscript. So every new draft was page one in the Platin, and that there were very few writers who had the patience to go through all of that. Nowadays, you know, you pound out words on the computer and you do a spell check, and it's easy to assume that it's ready to go. And unfortunately, that's what a lot of people do. And there's just a lot of dreck that gets pumped out, and then a lot of disappointment. And what I try to do in my videos is to kind of settle people down and make them understand that this is a real thing. I mean, everybody can write in the sense that if you know the alphabet, you put words on the page. But writing a story and creating characters and creating situations that are compelling is a craft. And like any other craft, whether you're building a house or, you know, it's playing golf even, you know, it's not a matter of going out and swinging a club. If you want to be a professional at it, you have to swing a club very well and very often with a lot of practice.
I want to get your perspective on this because this is something that frustrates me with, again, I'm talking more about the film and the screen world today where I want, maybe I'm an old-fashioned guy, John, but I want there to be a beginning, a middle, and an end. And I want the ending to be, if not a happy ending, at least some kind of resolution. One of my frustrations with so many movies nowadays is it's like they ran out of film and they didn't get to complete the story. They kind of just, okay, here come roll credits, and I'm sitting there going, wait a minute. And don't get me started on superheroes who suffer from angst. You know what? If you can fly to the sun, I don't want to hear about your family problems. No. And I've heard you talk about that a little bit. I mean, the reason we read novels in particular is to be entertained. And to share a little bit about your philosophy on that.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, a beginning, a middle, and an end. Not only does every book need to have that, in my world, every scene needs to have that. So people have a sense of satisfaction that they might not parse and drill too deeply to figure out why they didn't like this scene or why they didn't like this book, because it's all sort of behind the scenes. It's all where you can't see it. I think that, you know, if a reader is plunking down money for my books and then they take hours out of their day or out of their week to read the book, that's time they're not spending on Netflix or YouTube or NBC or, you know, whatever. So that's money and time that it's my responsibility to earn. And you earn it by giving people a satisfactory ride. It doesn't mean a happy ending necessarily, but it does mean a satisfactory ending that comes organically from everything that has preceded that. And I think what we're seeing a lot, in fact, I know this is the case in film, because I've done some film work, you can become a filmmaker and having never taken a course in storytelling. You know, you get your degree in filmmaking and you know how to work cameras and you can do special effects, you can do all of that, but not necessarily how to tell a story. And I think it's reflected in a lot of what we see out of Hollywood.
Yeah, Laura and I just watched a film we didn't make it through the end of the film, but about middle we turned it off. And I remember turning to her and saying, you know, if I had $1 million and was on an acid trip, that's precisely the product that I would put out. So we were not satisfied. And I love the fact that you take feedback from your readers. John, we come back. I'd like to talk a little bit about sex, violence, and bad language. Stick around, folks. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with John Gilstrap. John started off, well, spent a lot of his career, 15 years as a firefighter, and now he's a very, very successful author, mostly in the novel genre. But John, we talked about Operation 6 Minutes to Freedom, about Operation Acid Gambit, and we've got just a few minutes left, but I'd like you just at your website, johngilstrap.com, you got these very helpful videos. Now, before you came on the show, I did some asking around, John, and rumor has it that you have a tendency to be a little free with creative language. So I want to say I'm very proud of you so far for limiting that.
My mother would be very happy. I've been good. Yeah, in real life, there are some words that are just universally applicable, and one in particular begins with F, and I have not used that here, nor do I put it in my books. I don't use it in my writing, but I do use it in my real life.
Let's talk about that, because I found your little short on sex, violence, and bad language very enlightening when it comes to telling, you know, sharing with other authors what works and what doesn't. And some of the best advice you ever read was leave out the parts that readers tend to skip.
Yeah. I didn't originate that. I think that came from Elmore Leonard, but yeah.
And so in your novels, well, particularly the one I'm reading, post-apocalyptic, no zombies, but sex doesn't really fit in. It kind of chokes the story a little bit.
Well, I think the books from the 70s and 80s, where there was always, even thrillers, the obligatory sex scene, it stops the plot. You know, look, the whole world's coming apart. We need to save it, but first, let's do it. It never made sense to me. And on the issue of language, in my early books, Nathan's Run is about a 12-year-old who kills a juvenile detention center guard and runs away. And it won all kinds of awards. It became a worldwide bestseller. But it had really bad language. And it was the language that I use when I speak. And I've got so many then letters and later emails from people who say, I wish I could share this story with my mother, son, husband, you know, relative of some sort or friend, but the language is so bad, I can't share it. And I thought, okay, I don't get that, actually. I mean, words are words. Okay. But I'm in a business, and if what I'm doing, if something as easy as not using certain words keeps readers engaged and keeps them reading, then why not go their way? And I haven't used really high-end profanity probably for 15 years, and I've never gotten an angry letter complaining about that. So
now, Nathan's Run, for a moment there, wasn't that one of the most banned books in America because of that?
It was. It won the Alex Award from the American Library Association, which is the best adult market novel for a juvenile audience. So it was packed into every middle school in the world, you know, and kids were taking it home and showing their parents, and that's, you know, then it blew up and became one of the most banned books in America, which parenthetically is really good for sales.
So do you get a certificate for something like that, or a little trophy, or?
No, you'd think you would, wouldn't you?
I don't know.
You know, something really profane.
You tell, and I don't know if profane is the right word, but you are also a screenwriter, and your experience with Hollywood has been, I'll just say, up and down. You tell a great story about a movie that you were supposed to write for about a smoke jumper, and in the context of whether it's appropriate to include sex in this part of the story or not. Tell that story real quick for us, if you would.
There was I'll never work in this town again if I reveal the names, but the director was crazy. And when he found out that I had read the book that the film was supposed to be based on, he was quite angry with me because he didn't want to adapt the book. But he had this scene of two people, a man and a woman, smoke jumpers, jumping into the middle of this conflagration. The whole world is on fire. And she, in her spare time, is a massage therapist. I'm not making this up, okay? So she's a massage therapist, and in the middle of the fire, they get naked, and she gives him a massage. So he's telling me this story, like, you know, he's got this scene in his head, and he pings the air with his hands, and when he's done, I'm laughing. And he said, "What are you laughing at?" I said, "You can't be serious." He said, "I am serious. But how am I supposed to do that?" He said, "You're the screenwriter. Make it happen."
John, so, I have been in 10,000 Acres Ablaze, and sex was the furthest thing from my mind. Just surviving and cutting line was that. And number two, the last thing you want to do is take off your protective gear. Period.
I would think so. I would think so. But you're not a big name Hollywood director, so reality doesn't matter to you, or does matter to you.
John, one of the other things, I was trying to take a one or two lessons from our guests, and I took a lot of. I'm taking a lot of. I feel a lot better after reading or watching a little video about rejection. And for aspiring writers out there or aspiring radio hosts, that's just part of the game. But and I tell you, reading your or watching your video, the first thing that came to mind is I'm going to go back and redo. I mean, I'm self-syndicating, so I've sent out hundreds of emails asking folks to listen to my sample. And it's very rare that I get any response. No, yes, maybe, nothing. I don't hear anything. But the lesson I took from you is, well, Ben, maybe that's the problem there is with your letter. Or your email. Maybe you need to fix that.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's called in my world, it's called a query letter, and you send it out. And if people are rejecting, you send out a query about your novel, and you're trying to get an agent, typically, and you get rejected. Well, it's a bad query letter because they haven't read your story yet. They don't know. I mean, it could be a dog of a story, but the query letter, if it's properly written, should get them to ask to see the dog of the story because it's pure advertising, right? It's a promotional piece. Hey, look at me. And if they don't want to look at you, there's a problem with the letter.
And it's a numbers game, right? You were rejected, what, 27 times before you got your first publishing offer?
Right. Well, you know, Jonathan Graves, the series that is probably most active, based on a former Delta operator, never let good research go unused. He's a freelance hostage rescue specialist. So if my agent received a query letter from somebody that wanted to do something that's sort of in the same lane, she's going to reject it because she already has a client that does that. You don't need the conflict of interest. So, you know, there's a thousand for any query letter to be accepted. It has to land on the desk of the person who wants to see it on the day that they want to see it that has no other conflict at the time. So it is a law of large numbers. It's like hitting a bullet with a bullet.
So at which point do you go from being an aggressive promoter to just a real pain in the patootie? I mean, how often should folks reach out to these folks before they just write them off?
Oh, once you get a no, it's a no.
Sure.
You know, it's unless it's an encouraging no. Sometimes the rejection will come in and say, you know, I really I like your style as a writer. This story isn't quite for me, but if you come up with something else, please feel free to send it to me. That's the best kind of rejection letter you can get. Most of them are just a no. Not for me.
That's fine. I don't mind sometimes when I'm trying to sell advertisers. Look, I don't mind hearing no, but just tell me something. So, I mean, to me, the takeaway from that whole experience is, and you say, in this business, the only way to lose is to quit.
That's right. I boil it down to failure cannot be inflicted. It can only be declared. So, you know, as long as the writer, the radio guy, the athlete, the singer, whatever it is, as long as you keep trying, you're still in the game. But if you stop trying, that's on you. That's not an outside force. Quitting is a choice.
John, I've really read what I've read so far. I'm going to go out. I really enjoyed what I've read so far. I'm going to go out and buy some more of your books and encourage folks to visit johngilstrap.com. And thanks for spending some time with us on your weekend.
It's been a lot of fun. Thank you very much for having me.
Take care. Ladies and gentlemen, you can find the podcast of this broadcast and over 300 others at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Whatever your favorite streaming platform is, if it's Amazon, if it's Google, if it's Apple, if it's Pandora, we're everywhere. The main thing is please share these messages with other folks that need to hear them. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of American Warrior Radio, this is Ben Bueller Garcia. All policies and procedures are to remain in place. Take care.
Listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 300 episodes of this program via AmericanWarriorRadio.com or the most recent episodes via your favorite podcast app.